Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're starting this show today by talking with you about candy. You might have a weakness for maybe a particular kind of candy. It might be a chocolate truffle. I like those. Salted caramels. I like those. A tangy fruit chew. I'm not as, it's not as high on my list, but maybe it is on yours, and I think there's something for the kid in all of us. And today we talk candy making just in time for Valentine's Day with our guest, Richard Hartle. He is a professor of food science at UW-Madison, and Rich's confectionery research includes controlling phase transitions of sugar, caramel, lipids, and ice cream. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Let us know the challenges you run into when you make candy. What do you want to know about baking sugar syrup, maybe? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Rich Hartle, welcome. Good to have you with us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
What's your favorite candy at the moment?
That would be the first question. And it varies. So we make a really mean orange slice. And so I often like those. But I also like salted caramels, chocolate-covered salted caramels. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, I think, almost any time of the year. How'd you get started in candy making and food science?
Well, long path. So I have a bachelor's degree in physics and a PhD in engineering, but that PhD was based on sugar crystallization. So I actually did a PhD on trying to understand and control sugar crystallization. So when I got hired here at UW, my predecessor, Joe Von Elb, kind of put his arm around me and said, "Rich, you know something about sugar crystals." And an old candy maker once told me that if you know how to control sugar in the phase transitions, you could be a good candy maker. And I like to joke now that, you know, I study phase transitions of sugars, but I'm not a very good candy maker.
Well, it's good to hear Joe Von Elb's name as well. Joe and I talked many a time on the show. And I always enjoyed, rest his soul, enjoyed him very, very much. Well, yeah. So what's so fascinating about making candy? Is it?
Well, for me, it's all about the science.
Yeah.
So I don't mind eating it at the end, although, like I said, I don't make good candy, so you don't always want to eat what I make. But for me, it's all about the science. And it's actually quite surprising how much science there is. I teach a senior level class for our food science students called Confectionery Science, and its reputation is that it's a lot of fun, but it's hard.
So what are the main categories of candies? I think we almost laid them out, but go ahead.
Well, there's the chocolate confections, of course, but it ranges everywhere from hard candy to taffy to caramels and fudge to marshmallow, even sweet tarts, tableted candies fit into that category. And again, there's many more in between. Even chewing gum. I notice you're chewing some gum.
Yeah.
Even that is considered in the confectionery category.
So which candies do you think are the most beginner-friendly?
Good question. A lot of them are easy to make, relatively easy to make. I would put caramel and fudge into that category. Even hard candy is relatively easy to make as long as you're careful about the high temperatures. Things that are hard to make, almost impossible in the kitchen, would be licorice. And if you tried to make chocolate from cocoa beans, that might be a challenge as well.
And I just read this morning that you should not be giving licorice for a Valentine's gift because it... what is it? Inhibits the libido? Have you heard that one?
No, but dark or black licorice, which is, you know, true licorice, the red licorice is really just, I mean, you look at some of the packages and they don't actually say licorice, but dark licorice that has the licorice extract is I mean, supposedly there's some, if you have high blood pressure, probably not good to eat a lot of it.
Anyway, okay. Let's talk about equipment. What are the basic equipment or pieces that a home chef needs to make candy?
Well, for the most part, you need a pot and a stove and a stirring and a, something to stir it with. A candy thermometer might be a good thing to have there as well, because a candy thermometer has the different levels of cook, so to speak. The soft ball, hard ball, soft crack, hard crack, and those are based on temperatures, based on viscosities, and ultimately the texture. So really, don't need for many of them. You don't need much more than a pot and a mixer.
And do you have a, in terms of, the thermometer I have a very expensive thermometer. Well, expensive for me. I think I paid $120 for it. But it you can use it for meat or whatever you want, including candies and so forth. Do you have a favorite one that you like?
Well, in our labs, we use cheap $10 ones because students tend to break them. But when we do our own, we've got one that's, it's probably a couple $100 that between the probe and the recorder. So yeah, they can be pretty expensive, just as long as you have something that goes to the right temperature range.
You're in good shape. Okay, so, and the ingredients, the foundation ingredients, sugar, I guess.
Yep. So sugar. So if you look at most candies, chocolate excluded, the first two ingredients are sugar and corn syrup, and maybe in different ratios. So typically, things that are crystalline or semi-crystalline have more sugar than corn syrup. Things that are not crystalline have more corn syrup than sugar. So in the candy parlance, we call corn syrup a doctoring agent, because it manipulates and controls the crystallization of the sugar.
So when you're using corn syrup, are you going to get a different kind of, what does it do? Does it give you a different kind of mouthfeel or make the candy different in some fashion, I suppose?
Yeah, if you use too much corn syrup, it gets it's kind of more, I don't know what the right term is. It's machinable, more plastic, I think would be the right term for it. And again, it prevents crystallization, but it also, depending on the type of corn syrup and how much you use, can also make it more sticky, hygroscopic. So all of those factors go into choices that we use in commercial candy making.
Karen emailed us. She loves to make her mom's divinity for friends for Valentine's Day. Sometimes it's perfect, light and fluffy. Other times it's dense. And she wonders what gives, and should she use water or oil-based flavorings and color rings?
So, I mean, that's an expanded sort of hard candy type of product, similar to some other types of things. Like in Wisconsin, we get I'm blanking on the name, chocolate covered sponge or foam, that kind of thing. And essentially, that's cooked up to hard crack, so you get moisture content pretty low. Foam it in some way. Often, it's just adding some bicarb and then getting it to cool quickly, so you've got a lot of air pockets, and they're held together by the glassy nature of that sugar phase. And so, a couple things that you could go wrong: you let the air escape after you've added the bicarb, or perhaps you didn't cook to a high enough temperature, and you have more water than you think you do, and it could be more dense because of that. Now, one thing, just to talk a little bit about the science, but I mean, we cook up to hard crack and get to a certain water content. Typically, that's 2 to 3% moisture, but the amount of moisture left in the candy also depends on what the atmospheric pressure is and the humidity of the air outside, and all of those can impact the final product. And in fact, I know some candy makers that in their by their candy station, they also have a barometer. And when the pressure goes up too high or down too low, they don't cook because they can't control the water content.
Wow. Rich Hartle, our guest today, professor of food science at UW-Madison. We're talking with him about candy making. Maybe you've got an experience to share, or maybe you've got a question about candy making. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Our producer today, Clara Neipert, our engineer, A. Emily Ralph. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with our guest today, Professor Rich Hartle, a professor of food science at UW-Madison, and he does a lot of research in the area of candy and candy making. We're talking kind of about the chemistry of it, as a matter of fact, with him, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your own experiences with candy making. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Dodeau was just texting, we were talking about a sea foam. She talked about sea foam, and is sea foam the same thing as divinity?
Differences, but essentially it's the same character of candy where, again, you got a foam, air pockets, that were produced by some, usually it's a chemical reaction with bicarbonate, and then the air is controlled or held by a sugar glass. So cook the sugar syrup up to a high hard crack temperature to bring the water down. And when it cools down, that sugar syrup turns into a glass.
Does it look like a glass?
It can. In fact, some of the old-time stories, some of the old-time Westerns, according to the stories I hear, I was not around back then, but so they used sugar glass to make the panes of glass that the bad guys went through. Because, you know, if you use silica, the glass transition is high enough and it's sharp enough that you cut. I mean, my mom said, don't play with glass. But they made them with sugar glass because they have the same appearance, same crack, but they're not as hard. The problem is they picked up moisture too fast, and so I couldn't use them after the morning. That's the story I hear.
Interesting. Let's go to Richard in Manitowoc. Richard, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the air. Yeah, I was going to ask your guest speaker, if I wanted to make my own throat lozenges and cough suppressants, what would be the best additive to put in there, and how would I go about it?
Cough suppressants. So that brings me back to my younger days, where anything candy-like was fair game. And so I often had a lot of sore throats because cough drops are really just candy with a little bit something else in there. And typically the things that they put in there are things like menthol. But I've seen cough drops that have something like a pectin. So something that thickens up the fluid. So when you swallow it, it coats your mouth. Coats your whatever as it passes down the throat. So, what's the best one to do? Boy, I don't have a good answer to that. But again, the cough drops out in the marketplace. I mean, the Luden's cough drops are still available, same ones that I had as a kid. And do they work? I don't know. I just enjoyed the candy part of it.
Richard, thank you for calling. Terry and Mequon will go to you. Hi, Terry.
Good morning. I was laughing when you talked about the divinity and not making it at certain points in the barometer. I, as a teenager, entered candy and divinity specifically at the county fair, which was held in late July, and our house had no air conditioning, and the humidity was up. It was about 90 degrees, and I was very determined to get this entry into the fair. And I remember scooping and my parents holding little plates out and running all over the house. And they'd stuck one in the freezer and some in the refrigerator and some on the shelf. And we had candy all over the kitchen.
What did you win? Did you win a prize, Terry?
I won first prize. Yes, I did. Yes.
Great. So the refrigerator freezer trick is actually a pretty good one because, one, it gets it cold, so it brings it down below its glass transition, even if there's a little bit extra moisture in it. Of course, as soon as you warm it up again, it starts to flow, and then it starts to suck up moisture from that humid air. It's one of the real problems with that kind of candy.
Oh, Terry, that's a great story. Thanks so much for sharing it. Appreciate it very much. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, sea foam is not made it's made with a sugar water and egg whites. Egg whites are what gives it the volume.
Egg whites are what rich. Thanks, Ruth. Rich comment.
Yeah, that's one of the ways of protecting the air cells. So egg whites, proteins are surface active, and so they go to the surface and help stabilize it. But the primary stabilization is the sugar glass. So both of those happen. Both of those are important.
Yeah. Ruth, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. We'll open lines, get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. You know, we've been throwing out and talking about sugars here, but really there are many different kinds of sugars. Which one is the most common for candy?
Well, oftentimes when we say sugar, we really mean sucrose. But sugar is a broad term, right? So corn syrup actually fits in the category of sugars because it's glucose, maltose, maltotriose. It's a glucose polymer. Starch is a glucose polymer that gets broken down to make corn syrup. Glucose and fructose, not uncommon. The combination of those is often called invert sugar. And so that can be either be added to candies separately, or actually through cooking or acid, can be caused or can be formed in the processing of candy. Those are the main ones. If you start looking at sugar-free type candies, then we're talking about sugar alcohols, which are not technically sugars, but they're derived from sugars. But things like maltitol, isomalt, things like that. And then there's some more exotic ones. So one that's kind of popular in the industry today is a monosaccharide called allulose. And it has some interesting properties like sucrose, and people are starting to use that as a sucrose replacement.
Interesting. Gene in Merrill has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gene.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have what's for me an amusing story from my childhood. My sister and I discovered the stages that divinity does go through as they're making it incorrectly, to our disadvantage. We were doing it on a summer day, and we obviously got it past the hardball point so that it was kind of gummy. And so we pulled it out and thought, well, maybe we could treat it like taffy. We didn't know much about taffy either, so we started pulling it, and that seemed doable. And then I got the bright idea. We could shape it into a ball, and it turned out to be about the size of a softball. So, of course, we took it outside, and I got the bat, and she got the ball, and she pitches it at me. I take a solid whack at it, and the thing breaks to smithereens. It's so hard by then. So I went leaping for it, fell on the ground, dislocated my kneecap to the side of my knee, and my poor father comes rushing out, and they have to call an ambulance. So to this day, I don't really like divinity a whole lot. I've never eaten any.
And it could get you in many ways.
Oh, that's a great story, Gene. Oh, well, I'm sorry that you hurt yourself, but it was a great story about divinity and making it and softball sized. Oh, Tim in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good morning. Years ago, this is back in the 50s when I was a kid, my mother made chocolate fudge, and she only made it in the wintertime. She'd take it out in the back porch where it's colder, and then she'd let it cool, and then she'd bring it back in, and she'd only turn it and beat it by hand. Then she'd put it back out. She did this like four or five times. It took her half a day to do this, but it turned out really delicious. And I was wondering what the on and off beating and getting it cold did to it.
That's a good question, Tim.
That's a good question, Tim. It's I mean, it's so fudge is a partially crystalline candy. So in fact, we call in the commercial candy industry, we call fudge a crystallized caramel. So it's basically the same matrix as caramel, but then you partially crystallize it. And that's so if you've ever seen fudge being made at a resort type thing, they cook it off. And if they don't use fondant as a seed, then they pour it onto a table, allow it to cool, and then they work it by hand. And that working by hand is what's promoting the sugar crystallization. When you put it outside in the cold, of course, that's cooling down. Then you bring it back in and warm it back up a little bit and then beat the heck out of it. Why you would have to do that four times beyond me. But the aim of that process is to get a lot of really small sugar crystals that give that fudge-like texture to the product. So whatever it's doing by putting it in the Wisconsin winter and then bringing it back out and beating it, that's an interesting new technique that I've not heard of.
Tim, you know what? I bet you your mother did it four times because her mother did it four times. That's probably exactly why. But the product, and Rich, you can see where this would make for a pretty fine candy.
I think controlling the sugar crystallization that way, as soon as you cool it down to that low a temperature, it's becoming glassy-like. Not maybe a glass yet, but that's inhibiting sugar crystallization. When you warm it back up again and beat it, that's when the sugar crystals form. So, again, an interesting way of controlling that sugar crystallization.
Yeah. Tim, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it very much. Fran from Viroqua emailed us. Fran's made angel food every year for Christmas for many years. She recognizes it can be finicky based on humidity and weather. In recent years, it's consistently turned out dense instead of light and airy, despite every effort to be as precise and careful as possible. Fran has made sure her baking soda is fresh and replaced multiple candy thermometers. Any other suggestions?
Yeah. Sometimes variability comes. When you make chocolate chip cookies at home, often there's just some inherent variability from the different ingredients that you use and the different processes that you use. And the same is true for making candies. So some of those things we've talked about already, it could be the humidity and pressure. It could be that if you're using some corn syrup, it could be that that's different. So unfortunately, I don't have any magic to tell you there that it happens here as well, that sometimes we get things that work out and sometimes we get things that don't work out, even though we've made it 100 times before. So I don't know all of the ins and outs of the variability of the ingredients and the process. But again, it sounds like you're doing all the right things by controlling the temperature that you cook to. And again, you don't have any control over the atmospheric conditions, but unfortunately, that's the nature of things.
Thank you very much for that question, Fran. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your own question or maybe your own experience to share as we talk candy making with our guest today, Rich Hartle, from the UW-Madison Food Science Department, where he is a professor. You know, chocolate, I was thinking back before the show. There was a lady, and this is when I was a young guy, from Illinois, and a friend of mine knew her, and she made chocolates, and they were just the best chocolates you could ever made. And the story with her was she got her chocolate from Hershey's. Hershey used to sell its best chocolate. You could buy it as anybody could buy their top of the line chocolate before they added everything to it. And then they quit doing that. They wouldn't allow it to be sold just to anybody. And the lady from Illinois made some of her chocolates up. She still had some of the Hershey's, the good Hershey's chocolate left, and she made it and sent it to the president of Hershey's. And he said, anybody, and he, she got a letter back, anybody that makes candy this good, chocolate this good, deserves to have our chocolate. So she became the only person who was allowed to buy chocolate from Hershey's. And I guess if you're making chocolate, chocolate varies quite a bit. And maybe you can talk a bit about that.
Sure. So there are a lot of chocolate suppliers. And again, Hershey is typically not one that that we talk about. But there's a number of different suppliers that you can buy chocolate from of a wide variety. And most of the people that supply chocolate have kind of a low end, cheaper chocolate, and all the way up to a higher couverture type of thing. And typically, the difference between those are there's a number of things. One is the quality of the beans that the chocolates are made from. Mm. So there's better beans than other beans that have been fermented correctly, been roasted properly, and with the right characteristics. Most chocolates are mixtures of blends of different cocoa beans from different sources to get the specific flavor that a company is looking for. Nowadays, you can buy single origin chocolates from some companies, and you know they can have particularly good profiles as well. If you walked around, so Madison has, what, four or five different high-end chocolatiers, and they all buy their chocolate from a variety of sources, whether it's a French source or a Belgian source or California source or even Chicago. But again, each chocolate has a different characteristic based on the ingredients that were used to make it and the processes that they were used to make it. So they're pretty wide range of characteristics. Yep.
Yeah. Purchased a lot of Gail Ambrosius chocolates, and she actually goes to South America she travels there to visit the places to see the process in action, and makes some pretty good chocolates.
She brings back some beans, I think, and makes her own single origin as well.
Yeah. Yes. Suzanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to follow up on the idea of candy glass, using it for windows. And it's still in use by the movie industry. As a matter of fact, when Men in Black was filmed at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, there was a crashing through the front doors, and the front doors are glass, but they were replaced with candy glass so the actors weren't hurt as they were crashing through the door. So it's still in use.
Oh, Suzanne, thank you.
Yeah, my understanding was that most of that had been replaced by polyurethane type thing. So if you go look at movie glass, you know, the thing that bottle that's made with a glass-looking material that people bonk over the heads, now that's mostly polyurethane. But, yeah, it's interesting.
Thank you, Suzanne. I appreciate that very much. Bruce in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Your turn. Thank you for calling, Bruce. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hello. It's a great show. I have some friends that have a candy shop in Knife River. It's called Great Lakes Candy Kitchen, and they make great candies and chocolates. But they have said to me they're using a big copper bowl when they make the candy, you know, so they're hand mixing it and so on, and it's delicious. They make great candy. And so I just wondered what's the deal with the copper pot or copper bowl?
Yeah, good question, Bruce. Thanks for calling. Rich, what about it?
Yeah, copper is sort of the traditional kettle material that was traditionally used to make candy. We have a bunch of those here in our labs as well, although we're phasing those out because harder to control. But the reason copper works so well is because it transfers heat really nicely. So it has a very high thermal conductivity for heat. And if you put flame down on the bottom, the heat transfers all the way up the sides, and so you get a more uniform cook. Stainless steel, on the other hand, is a lot easier, but and easier to clean and better actually for the shelf life of the product, but it doesn't transfer heat quite as well. So one of the reasons copper is not so great is because copper ions actually promote lipid oxidation. So if you're making English toffee, for example, in a copper kettle, your shelf life will be a little bit lower because of lipid oxidation over time.
Thanks for that question. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning. I have a daughter and her husband and two little granddaughters up in Sitka, Alaska. Well, they make caramels up there. Their license goes all over the world, and they're called the Sweet Sisters Caramels. Well, a while ago, I had two caramels left, and Mary called me one day, and I said, you know what, Mary, I only have two of those caramels left. And what do you know, in about a week and a half, I got a box with, I don't know how many, there must have been about 8 or 10 boxes of caramels in there. And I have four different flavors. But boy, I'll tell you, when you talked about candy, darn it, I thought, you know what, I got that box of those caramels in the closet. I'm going to have to go and get them out, otherwise I eat too many. And I got one in my mouth right now as we're talking. And it is really good. But, you know, licensed all over the world, they can send them. But it's from Sitka, Alaska.
Oh, Sitka, Alaska. Well, Nancy, thank you for that. Sitka, Alaska. Sitka salmon is, there's another kind of at least a national brand, but that has to do with fish. Salmon, for sure. And is it tough to... You know, I'm thinking about this. You got candy you're selling all over the world. I mean, how do you make? You got to have some pretty quick delivery, or and you know the temperatures and the summer and so forth. Rich, I assume there's problems.
Yeah, shipping candy can be real, real challenging. Some of them are much more sensitive than others. Caramel is actually fairly robust. You know, some of the caramels you buy at a grocery store, granted, they're not as good as the Sitka caramels, I'm sure, were probably made 6 months ago and have that kind of shelf life. But typically, a high-end gourmet caramel, sounds like that's what you're getting, has a higher water content and tends to cold flow or deform, even at room temperature. And of course, if it goes into a warm environment or a warm truck, it can flow pretty bad. So, yeah, some candies are again more robust than others. Of course, you know that you can't ship chocolate in the summertime unless you have a really good insulated box with some cold packs as well.
Thanks again, Nancy. Amy in Door County, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Admittedly, my question is more about baking, but the question part has to do with chocolate, so I hope you might be able to answer this for me. My son has a dairy-free diet, and I was just wondering if using carob chips melted as an icing or frosting on cookies, would that be a direct substitution for real chocolate?
Well, in my opinion, no, because carob has a very different flavor. Looks the same, maybe behaves the same a little bit, but I don't think it tastes the same. But if it's non-dairy, almost every dark chocolate, not everyone, but almost every dark chocolate is non-dairy. I mean, by definition, it's cocoa solids, which and cocoa butter, which comes from a plant, then sugar, which is plant-based, and then a few other things, but lecithin and vanilla are the main other ingredients. If there's a little bit of milk fat or, of course, a milk chocolate, then, of course, but a lot of companies are now making dairy-free milk chocolates. So oat-based milk chocolates are becoming common as well. But again, you can make a dark chocolate coating that's non-dairy.
Yeah, there you go, Amy. It's probably a little more expensive, a little higher end, but you can do it for sure. So check that out. Stephen, Green Bay, hi.
Hey, Larry. I've got a question about flavorings. My mother used to make it's a hard crack stained glass candy that she used to flavor cinnamon, wintergreen, clove, those sorts of things with oil. And I swear she only used a couple of drops. And when my sister and my wife and I made it this Christmas, we bought similar, what we thought were oils from a store called Michael's. And we had to really put a lot more into it than what my mom did. And I was wondering if the professor could tell me what's going on there.
Okay.
Yeah, so flavors are a whole interesting field within the food industry. And there are huge flavor houses, there's what we call them, that that mix up all the different chemicals that go into some of those flavors. And so probably the actual flavor and component in what you got was lower than what your mom got. I mean, I don't know for sure, but a typical flavoring like that is mostly the carrier, and that carrier can be water or it can be oil. And then the flavoring compounds themselves and the concentration of those flavoring compounds, you know, it can vary depending on the source of that flavor. So that would be my guess, is that you just got a flavor system that just didn't have the same concentration.
Hmm. There you go. Thank you for calling, Steve. Daryl in Menominee Falls. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I think I found my answer as far as why, when you watch the old Westerns, how John Wayne and Clint Eastwood could fall through a saloon window and not get a cut on them or ride their horse right through it. So I found this sounds a very practical way of reusing candy.
Well, they made those panes specially for the movies. Again, it's sugar glass, but not as sharp and brittle as a silica glass.
Rich, two of your students won $1 million in a TV show, The Amazing Race. I think I emailed you once and said, hey, would you mind if I have them on the show? How are those, they're not kids for sure. They were PhD students. How are they doing?
Well, I still talk to most of my former students. Amy, she worked on a sugar project, so she actually worked on a sugar replacement, sorbitol. But she works now for Mars Wrigley. She's a high-level research scientist there with a PhD. And then Maya Warren, who was on the ice cream side of things, she went to work for a company and then did a couple other things. But now she's a consultant on her own, working with anybody that has ice cream questions. So they're both doing really well.
That's good. I watched every episode of The Amazing Race they were on, and it was really fun having them on. I just wondered how they were doing. And you don't often get millionaires for PhD students. At least sure. I never did.
Yep.
Some of them might have made a million afterwards. But, Rich, I tell you what, this has been a lot of fun. Would you come back and do this again with us? We had lots of questions that we didn't get answered, to be perfectly honest.
Sure, I'm happy to do it.
Thank you so much. Richard Hartle, I should say, everybody calls him Rich, is a professor of food science at the UW-Madison. It's great to have him with us. We never really did get into his research at all, and I think we get him on again. I want to maybe delve into that a little bit. Well, you know, we've talked chocolate and related it to Valentine's. What's the other thing you think about when you think about Valentine's Day and maybe gifts? One I think of is flowers, and we're going to talk about flowers next here on the Ideas Network with the owner of the Petal Pusher Floral Studio in Green Bay. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.